one, so I thought it was heroic. But
no, that was an environmental activist group saying that. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm making even bigger than you are. But, so she is from a very, very, how do you call it, versatile. The first question I want to ask you, and it's rather a serious one, you're a member of parliament. How do you exist within that system? Because now you're in the system. How do you operate? What makes you different from the other parliament members of parliament?
Oh, well, that's a very good question. And so I have two guidelines. One is I follow my heart and my intuition rather than frames or set sort of path on how to operate within the system. I'm very curious and I really like to empower the parliament in such a way that that's the boss, not the executive branch. I don't care if I don't have this job tomorrow. That is the biggest strength I have in there, because then I can just do whatever I want to and not be afraid to lose following or whatever.
So, and why do you say that? That's the biggest... You feel that a lot of other members of parliament do care if they have the job tomorrow, and because it's their job, not because it's their vocation? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I mean, people often come in there with passion to change the system, and then they become assimilated into the system if it becomes a life mission to be in there. Then you're very worried if you do something or say something that is not popular. Especially, you just look at parliamentarians just before elections. Like the year before, it is just so pathetically theatrical, and you know that they're lying because they really just want to carry on. And but the root cause for it, and I don't want to paint everybody with dark colors, but the root cause is that people are on a mission. We might not always agree with their vision, but they want to carry on being able to execute that vision. And so that in order to get out of that, the best hack about that is to open it in such a way that the civilians can actually have more influence on the policies that are being made in the parliaments.
And as a person, your advice is don't stuck to the path, see other possibilities, always see other possibilities to reach your goals. And isn't
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's important that just in life in general to recognize that there are many paths and no path is the right or the wrong path. So in general, when you are in politics in this day and age, where we see the rise of the extremists, the rise of the fascists, the rise of the neocons in different disguises, what is our remedy? How do we get people to choose a different path than the path of those that speak into our fears? What is the opposite of fear? And so we have to, the different path can be to inspire and create the tools for people to be more engaged and understand that they have a role and responsibility in co-creating their society.
Thank you. I just said with big words that we will be talking about new citizenships in a digital world. But what does it mean to be a citizen? What do you think? What is it to be a citizen? As opposed to a person or an individual?
Well, I guess being a citizen is being a part of a particular community. I actually have a philosophy myself where I don't feel that I belong to any particular tribe or religion or country. And that comes from having grown up online, where I felt that we lived in a sort of borderless world. I recognize that many people don't feel comfortable with that. So I see myself as a citizen in any community that I am engaged in. I guess that applies to everyone else, is that you are a citizen of the community you're in, not necessarily a citizen of a structured country, but a citizen of your community.
And that is very fluid. Like you said, you can be a part of the community today, which is totally different from the community tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And does that link with this digital thing? I mean, that's maybe a change which was brought about by the digital revolution, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I live on an island with 330,000 people. and they speak like this. Þetta er nú meiri anskotans helvítis. So you see, you will not necessarily see a very brilliant future for a poet in this environment, right? So I started to, actually my first webpage that I created back in 95 was a way to reach out to other people with my poetry, and I started to write in English. And that just meant that it just completely opened my world, and I got to start to work with action poets, like I call them, poets that are, you know, engaged in trying to have an impact on the world around them. And it just completely transformed my life. If I had not gone online back in 95, I would be very bitter somewhere in a basement in Iceland, feeling extremely sorry for myself. And so I'm forever thankful for the internet, because it opened a possibility to reach like-minded people. And that is why everything is changing so fast, because like-minded people are connecting.
And how do you reach out? How do you try to connect with people who may not beforehand agree with you or feel like you? Or how do you try to reach them? Can you tell us something about that?
Well, I don't have a particular strategy. So one thing I do in the so-called constituency week, where you're supposed to go out in your constituency, I very often invite people to come to movies with me. So I show a documentary, and then, you know, invite people to come for free, and then we can have debates afterwards. And then, you know, I usually show something thought-provoking. For example, I showed the documentary about Aaron Swartz. Aaron Swartz, the internet's own boy, and I showed Plastic Planet, and, you know, about the IMF in Argentina, when IMF was in Iceland, and so forth. That's one way. Another way, one of the things, when we were creating the Pirate Party, we created that in 2012, so we didn't have any money, so I thought, why don't we just go into the flea market and get a booth there and ask people to give us stuff so that we can sell, you know, used stuff, and meet everybody in the flea market, because that's where you get people from all walks of life. And that was incredibly successful. We were making balloon swords for children, and then the parents felt that the need to support us to run. and all the other parties then all of a sudden were in the flea market later on, when we discovered it was a good way.
So making the news, that's the way to get votes.
No, it wasn't about the votes, it was just to get the right to vote, to run. No, I would not want people to give me a vote because I gave them a balloon sword.
Okay. What is it you want to achieve with your work? I mean, it's the last question I'll ask you for now. It's a very broad one, but it opens hopefully the floor for you to give a last word or a last advice.
My dream is that people understand that every one of us have the capacity to change the world, and that they recognize that they have a responsibility in co-creating their own communities. And I mean, that's it. I mean, we have to recognize that we're running out of planet, and if we don't really change the way we run our own lives and our smaller and bigger communities, we're really fucked. So wake up, people.
Okay, thank you, Birgitta. Can you please pass the mic to the person next to you, who is Dimitri Tognetis. He studied history, so he's, by the way, a Dutchman, but we'll talk in English, of course. He studied history, and he's a journalist and a blogger for the Dutch web paper, The Correspondent, a data journalist, so he has a specialization. And he is also a writer of a book called The
Deep... It's not the right debate that we are talking about, because privacy is such a cultural thing, it's really difficult to grasp. Everybody has ascribes different meanings to it and have different expectations of it. But what is really happening, what we are losing focus of, is not really privacy, but that the gathering and the use of information leads to another question, that is a question of power. There's an information asymmetry. What we often don't see is how information about us is being used by all kinds of parties to make decisions about us.
I've heard someone say communication is a two-way street. I mean, when you communicate, another one can see you as well or hear about you. So it's not just sending, but it's also being watched.
I think it's a one-way street because you often don't know that you are being watched or that you are losing all kinds of data and all different matters. You know? We're building this big Internet of Things, they call it, where you even have to be suspicious of your own devices in your home, your thermostat, for instance, or your TV. Samsung just updated their privacy policy that you have to be careful with what you say in front of your own TV.
Really?
Yeah.
Because otherwise?
Well, there's this functionality in your TV, which is really convenient, that you can say, change the channel, please, to NPR2, I want to watch next, for instance. That speech has to be processed somewhere and made into a command that a computer can understand. And that you cannot do that on a TV because the amount of memory is too small and the CPU power is too little. So they wire that to their own servers, and then they analyze that and they give the command back. The same happens with a Barbie doll, for instance. Mattel just introduced a Barbie doll on the American market that actually talks to the child in question, and that has some artificial intelligence, but it's not built into the doll itself, because the doll is very little. They have a very slim waist.
Yes,
you
have,
So you cannot. You cannot put artificial intelligence.
Oh, that's why they just speak about Barbie.
I can make very bad comments here, but I won't. But what they do is actually transfer the data to a server somewhere else. They process the data, use all kinds of artificial intelligence on that, and then send it back.
So it's like a fisher who catches
Fitbits, for instance, to when they are going running. That's really nice, but if your insurance company gets that kind of data, they can make decisions for you to raise your premiums, for instance, or to lower them, for instance. Those kinds of things. Life makes us show how technology works to people, and that you don't need to be scared of it. It's not that difficult to comprehend, but that it's also not innocent. We tend to see technology as a neutral thing, but it's not. Every piece of technology is imbued with politics and ethics. And I try to show that in my work, and I try to explain that to the people around me and get them off Facebook and WhatsApp.
And did you say how the internet is being used as a space for states to play out political issues? So we have noticed that since a few years, the internet is also being used as a kind of area of war for states, where they use stories to contradict each other and to influence each other's image.
Can you give an example? I think I understand what you mean.
Yes, I think a good example is now maybe more about the right to how we could think about the internet as a place where you could demand the right to your own truth rather than a truth or one truth.
So that we have billions of truths.
Yes.
We do have billions of truths.
We do.
And some truths are truer than others.
Definitely part of that is like a kind of global infrastructure that covers the whole globe and consists of law on the one hand, a physical infrastructure like cables and data centers on the other hand, users, platforms like social media and interfaces on the other hand. And in this global computation that is the internet, all these truths exist and overlap.
It's out of your statement.
Oh, do I still have time? I make things. I'm a designer and artist. So I want to say something that has something to do with the future of our imagination, and less to do with the so-called end of privacy. Though these things are sure connected, because when surveillance disables our thinking, we can surely not imagine anything. And the idea of an independent cyberspace that exists off limits to the state's territorial power is deeply rooted in the idealism of the early internet. It's like the sea once was. An unregulated and fluid space that today is overlaid with restrictions, surveillance, and infrastructures. And it feels less and less like a network and more like a series of platforms. In 2010, WikiLeaks made transparency a pop phenomenon, and made the dual principles of accountability suddenly hip and trending. And thanks to Edward Snowden, we now know what surveillance looks like when it stares into the mirror and sees itself. The NSA logos found in the PowerPoint presentations that Snowden leaked show that even the most secret operations cannot exist without visual representation. Art and politics belong together, but we know that their merger can be dangerous. While there may be no such a thing as political beauty, we instinctively do feel that all beauty is political. All aesthetics are political.
Excuse me, why is that? Why is all aesthetics political?
And the reason for her to leak those documents was a personal decision. Right? She felt that it was necessary for her to reveal that type of information, war crimes essentially. So, but it had a geopolitical impact. So maybe I think also ties in with some of the stuff that the book says, that personal decision that you can make. May have a global impact. May have a
But it was about politics and art, and I press a bit on it because this whole exhibition, of course, is about the intersection of politics and art. So I'm really interested I would like to know more about why politics and art for you go together.
Because it's just for me personally, the why they go together is that the every form of every idea that needs representation touches upon art, right? Every visualization of something touches upon art. We can go to a lot of philosophy like Walter Benjamin that say that can also be very dangerous. But in our practice, what we try to do is come up with different visual strategies to maybe equip progressive politics with images that can also help in the debate of in the current political debate.
Is your statement long? Because
I think
sounded impolite. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to
go.
Okay, thank you. The next person is Jolle Demmers. She's from Utrecht, actually. She works here. She's a scholar at Utrecht University. And she, founded, but she's head of the conflict studies department. And I think you had to do with the founding of it. And then the focus in this conflict studies department is on human rights. So it's an engaged type of science.
That's not true.
Okay.
We have a program, Conflict Studies in Human Rights. But
yes.
The Center for Conflict Studies is very much working on violent conflicts.
Okay. Thanks for the question.
Yeah, that's good too.
Her recent work is on remote control technologies, so that's one reason that she's here. And these are technologies for warfare, but also for aid industry. Tim, how you are doing that in your practice?
Yeah, from critical social theory, that is the essence of what we do, to not take for granted the institutions and forms of social power that are presented to us as normal. And in my particular field, of course, to not take war for granted and all the institutions legitimizing war. So to always, always be critical and to never take things for granted and to always look at things as if you see them for the first time, in a way. So it's very much a gaze, it's very much a way of looking at the world that I think we share when it comes to critical academia and the artist, and then propose perhaps new ways of looking.
And what is it? How do you do that? I mean, I think you share...
It's hyper-interconnected and hyper-complex at the same time.
So this means all sorts of things for legislations, which are mostly state-organized organized... on space, on the place where you are, so...
That's what contemporary warfare is about. So if you want to do conflict analysis, you've got to be able to understand all these... You have to understand the drone pilot sitting in this Nevada container.
He's still called a pilot. He's just...
Yeah, that's what they call themselves.
Okay. Dream on.
And you've got to understand how these Somali men were capable of mobilizing and sort of getting to this kind of action. So there's a lot of theaters and arenas that you have to be able to understand through different analytical vocabularies.
And that's what you are trying to do.
So that's one of our cases. Yeah.
It's also fascinating. Yeah, of course. Thank you. You are a couple. I don't know if you are in real life, but I will treat you as a couple. She will play in Tivoli. She's a big star, in case you didn't know. She lives in San Francisco, and her work is primarily about computer-based. So you make your music on your laptop. That's your instrument. Her most recent album is Platform, which was hold as a beautiful combination of experimental but also accessible music, which is, because of the complication, really a success, I think. Her songs are about our ambiguous interactions with technology. So she is intimate with her computer because it's her instrument, and being intimate with machines is a good thing, but you might become also a bit suspicious, and that's what she sings about and what she makes her songs about, because these machines can also keep you under surveillance, like we heard before. What is citizenship for you as a musician?
Well, can I introduce Matt as well?
Please.
And then maybe we can.
I didn't know how to because.
And then maybe we can answer the questions.
Okay.
Here.
Yeah.
Okay. So Matt Dryhurst is an artist and composer based in San Francisco. We're creative collaborators, and this year we released an album together, also with Metahaven, in collaboration.
You made a clip, didn't you? Yeah.
And he's also a software designer who released a piece of software this year called Saga, which is kind of questioning the way that artists publish their creative work online and who maintains control of that work. So now, do you want to answer what does it mean to be an artist?
I know you want to answer that question.
I think I can speak broadly to some extent too. I think citizenry really implies an agency, right? So things that we're both kind of principally interested in is this idea of actually being able to do something with your role rather than simply receive something, which when you talk about art creation or consumption or music creation or consumption gets very interesting. So citizenry, I don't think either of us necessarily affiliate with a particular country. As Brigitte was mentioning before, we are of an age where we did kind of grow up online and affiliate more with ideological concerns than nationalistic concerns. But citizenry principally is the idea of being able to do something and in an informed manner versus just receive information and kind of automatically respond.
And this is something that plays out in the music industry presciently, in that artists are often encouraged, just give everything away for free, or that's just the way things are, or you have to be an iTunes. Or there's all these rules that as a musician, if you want to make it or if you want to have an audience, you have to participate in certain ways. And so these are questions that Matt and I have been asking ourselves and our community and are trying to kind of work through, while also working within the infrastructure of a major independent record label. So questioning the system while working inside the system.
Yeah, because you need an infrastructure. That's always a paradox. You can be critical, but without an infrastructure, you won't reach anybody.
True, and artists may also be empowered to build their own infrastructures.
I think that's a good point as well, is that one of the things that we've really been interested in, we work with a legacy independent record label, so 4ID, and Revenge International, which is a more recent thing, and it's really interesting to see how that language of independence has been coerced into what we would now consider major distribution channels for the release of artwork. So anyone developing Spotify or YouTube, they listen to the legacy of independent music while centralizing the releases, standardizing contracts, basically determining the rules for everybody, as a major label would have done in the 80s. And so one of the things we're working on, and I'm working on with Saga, is re-instantiating an idea of independence within new networks, and re-instantiating the idea of, like, Discord or the original hardcore labels, that the way you release music is actually a fundamental part of the music, and simply uploading it to an Apple server, you know, there is some conflict with that, with the legacy of independent music and art.
Beautifully said, yeah. Because that's what struck me when I read into you, that music is not just hearing the sounds, but it is a very big, it's more or less an emblem for many things, like by participating in certain infrastructures or not, being critical, thinking about the themes, or expressing more or less the themes which are important to you. And, do you think that that it comes across to your audience?
That we're questioning these things?
Yes, or is it just that they enjoy the music point? Period.
I just did what I was told not to do. It's really important for us that it works on both levels. So it needs to, I think music should function in a visceral way, and I think it can also have multiple layers. So we often say that we use pop as a carrier signal. So it's the carrier signal that can travel really far, but it can be embedded with another message. And I think that's a really important point. You know, often in music journalism, you hear things about, or I'm criticized sometimes for, being too conceptual with my work or trying to put too many ideas into things, and I should just let music be emotional. And for me, actually, if the work is conceptual, it's then more emotional. It's then
so for you, that's a false opposite propaganda of your views and your music.
Exactly. So we're definitely trying to approach it from that direction.
You want to add something?
Yes.
I thought so. That was
No, I just agree. I mean, I think, again, to speak to the legacy of such things, like, there is a wonderful history of music that is kind of embedded with a greater political message, mm-hmm. And we've seen the dearth of that. And so Platform and many of the other projects we've worked on together, we're very much trying to find kind of new affects for new problems. Because simply, kind of, you know, most people, if you look at like a cell phone advertisement now, there's a musical affective language that's been borrowed from the 60s and the 70s. It's not necessarily radical to be a hippie in an aesthetic context today, but when looking at the work of a lot of people here, what are new affects, new production techniques, new ways of performing that can more accurately protest than simply borrowing from a protest language of the past, which, you know, we have a lot of reverence for, but may not be applicable or sufficient to deal with some of the issues that that face us now.
Okay. A last question before we go to our last but not least chairperson. I could ask it to all of them, but well, you have the mic, so I'm asking it to you. And that's something I wonder about, and it is that you say that you are free, like Birgitta said as well, that growing up in a digital age makes you freer to choose your own community. But I often think politics is about living in a community with people you don't agree with and who really think differently and with different concerns and different, aims and goals. Are you not avoiding this, sidestepping politics by looking for your affiliates all over the world? And I mean it not as a criticism, but really as a question.
I think, again, that's a false binary. I think that you can both create a community of like-minded people and also be a member of your local community or whatever community that thinks in a different way. We were actually just talking about before this talk that I grew up in Northeast Tennessee, which is a very conservative Republican part of the United States. And even though I politically disagree with most of my previous neighbors, it was really nice growing up there because I have an understanding of why people think the way that they do. And that gives me then, therefore, a deeper understanding of my own beliefs. Again, I think that's a false binary.
Okay.
And just to speak to it as well, I mean, there's a reason, and we actually do this with some liability toward our personal practice. Part of the reason you might not actually even know my name is because we choose to do this through a musical outlet. And one of the things that one of the actually wonderful things about music is, in a sense, it's a very populist medium. So we play to feasibly millions of people a year. And we're going in that environment with no protections. to speak about such things. And so, I mean, I think that question with regard to the kind of, you know, the elitist or removed art world is slightly more pertinent than it might be to music. But music is actually a wonderful means of throwing yourself in with the lions. And so choosing to push this message in that environment isn't easy, but it also feels somehow more satisfying, because you'd be surprised how many people are fed crap that are actually very interested in these issues, but just aren't being presented with them on a regular basis.
Thank you. This goes back to your previous question about whether or not something should just be immediately enjoyable or whether something can be conceptual. And that's kind of the power of music in a way, is you can actually get people in a room who might disagree on many things to publicly emote together. And that's actually a very powerful thing that we're trying to pull out of people. I'm convinced.
Thank you. Well, last but not least, like I said, I'm looking for my notes, because it's about totalities, it's about relationships between artists, it's about dialogues between works. So I cannot say you should only see this, because then I would be doing great injustice.
Okay, let's say,
to many of the artists.
Ina made you jealous, I know she did. What do you envy most? What is the work that you would like to present also?
Well, I think I mentioned this morning. I think the work by Johan Grimondpré is particularly interesting, because it actually posits a new understanding about what politics is, or a new approach to politics. And he introduces a word that is hardly ever used in politics, and that's the word love.
Beautiful.
And to me, this is a very radical political statement. It's also a radical artistic statement, because love is something we never talk about. We never talk about it. We consider it sentimental. We consider it something that is actually limited to the private domain, our lovers, our friends, our spouses, our partners. When in fact, if we actually deployed love in other facets of life, from society to politics, maybe we can imagine a world that is a slightly better place than it is today.
And what are you thinking of? How could I do that? For example, as a person, how can I deploy love in a political sense?
Well, first of all, you have to practice what you preach. And that is also, I think, a very political statement. Because you can, in fact, go to a quote-unquote political exhibition, and you can see very high-minded art, but you have to ask yourself, what is the motivation? Why is this being made? Who is it actually being presented to? And does the action of the person in real life, and of course this is a philosophical question, actually correspond to what we see? So that's my primary criteria. For example, when I select something for a show, I want to know that there is a correspondence and there's a real motivation behind it.
Okay. It was just something which popped into my mind earlier, because I think somebody mentioned fear. And I've heard, and it sounds very spiritual, that the opposite of fear is love. And that's a sort of connection, that if you dare to love, maybe fear disappears and maybe there's opposition. But well, this is a very sweet Christmas-like pronouncement. You combine, you have your art exhibitions made through a political or with political motivations. I think what I've learned from you is that you can't dissect it. You can't really analyze it and totally make these binaries. But, well, you need it for this sort of talk also, you know. What is for you the connection between art and politics? You've lived with it for a long time, so I'm very interested in your answer.
Well, yes. First of all, again, I'll repeat something I said this morning. You know, art is not obliged to be political. Art can be whatever it wants to be. An artist should be free to say whatever they want and to say it in whatever way they want to. So art can be conceptual, it can be minimal, it can be poetic, it can be aesthetic, it can be esoteric, it can also be political. I can only say that I cannot see art and the role of the artist outside outside of politics and of society and of all these big issues that we also see in Ina's show. And why personally can I not see that? Is because I think we're inhabiting an increasingly apolitical society, where the question of choice is actually mostly boiling down to consumer choice or to choices of sort of elusive democracy and citizenship.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean the following, and you asked everyone else, you know, what is citizenship? Citizenship is, of course, about our relationship to the world.
It's about our relationship to others. It's about actually making informed and responsible choices in society. It is the actual opposite of what Margaret Thatcher said, which is that there is no society. No, there is a society, and we are all a part of it. And that is what citizenship is about. Now, digital citizenship, because that's another question, is also about all these things. But what is digital citizenship? Digital citizenship is also about a certain responsibility about what you say in the internet, in the digital domain, in social media. The fact that we have an open platform that we can all use doesn't mean we can say whatever we want. It's very much like freedom of speech. There is no unlimited freedom of speech. Every speech act is an act of responsibility. And one has to ask oneself, where does my freedom end and where does yours begin? So, yes, I'm answering perhaps two questions
there. I'm ready with you.
And, of course, digital citizenship is no substitute for real political engagement, just as Facebook friendship is no substitute for real friendship.
But if I hear the implication of what you're saying, then you're saying because of the way the internet is used now, we need a sort of regulation or a sort of etiquette, at least.
I mean, there is no society where there have been no rules, no structures, that there has to be some form of structure. And as you were talking about binaries before, everything can be deployed for good and for bad. And what we need to safeguard is, of course, the open structure of the internet, the fact that it's being increasingly privatized. Of course, I mean, there are either ors, but I think we all, at least of us, all of us who are here, we know in which ways the internet can be deployed in a positive way, and we know how it can be deployed in a negative way. And I think we're all concerned to keep it as open and as free as possible.
Okay, thank you. I think it's about time, and there is a person here, Radie van Zutphen. He is the Nationale Ombudsman, and that means that he is the spokesperson for an organization which helps